Ignoring his question, I reach forward, taking one of Leary's tendrils and running it through my fingers, her trilling sound softening to a high-pitched purr that saws in longer, more languid drags until her breaths turn deep and even. Slowly, I edge away. Careful. Quiet. She doesn't so much as twitch as I ease to a silent stand, walking free of the rune's frosty embrace, mindful not to disturb the luminous drawings smudged into the stone. I make for the cave's clamorous entrance, Khan's thumping footsteps following close behind. Reaching the fall of water, I pause, arms crossed, peering out at the downpour, unsurprised to see Rygun coiled on the landing patch, though barely fitting on it. A single ember eye peers at the hutch's entrance with lazy intrigue while he rumbles through long, heavy breaths. The hutch keepers confirmed that Leary belonged to Rek Zaros, I say, my tone cool and calm, precise. It speaks nothing of the well of rage simmering beneath my ribs like a firestorm. I've spent all of this past Aurora cycle listening to that moonplume howl as she's been forced to relive the sizzling pain of each weeping welt that asshole dealt her, and there's only one remedy to this brewing fury. One. They also informed me that he's hunting for the Shade's missing princess. Is that right?
It is.
Khan rumbles from just behind my left ear. There's a lengthy pause. Then,
this male did more than simply capture you, Ingor.
Such a dangerous, prickly question, passed to me like a freshly sharpened weapon I'm wary enough to handle gently, with careful precision. Correct. He steps so close I'm engulfed in the dense aura of his body heat, a shiver crawling up my spine despite his welcome warmth.
Would you like to enlighten me, Moonbeam?
My mind tunnels back to a churn of red hair, the smell of blood, soft, pale skin that was too cold when I pressed my lips against it and whispered an acrid goodbye. He took someone from me, I rasp.
Who?
There's menace in his voice. Fiery, ferocious menace. I swallow, battling the urge to release another violent shiver, his electric rage feeding the feral part of me chafing for release. Someone I loved. A heavy beat of silence, and I can feel the thump of his thoughts like tumbling boulders clanking against each other.
Was he the one who whipped you?
The words are blazing coals, too hot to handle. Give them a single breath of life and they'll incinerate. I leave them there. Don't touch them or feed them. Don't even acknowledge their sizzling existence. I believed Khan when he said he wouldn't kill Rek, understanding the political implications if he were to harm him on burned soil. I also believe there's a line that borders that well of self-control. A line I can sense, just like I can sense him standing behind me. A firm, hot-blooded male containing a churn of barely tethered rage. Sometimes, it's best to leave things unsaid. How long will he be here, being escorted around the city?
Another few cycles, perhaps. He's thorough. I suspect my brother's emissaries are here to scope our military weight, more so than to hunt for his missing daughter, so I've got them under arrest in their guest suites.
A streak of lightning momentarily splits the sky. Do you know where he plans to go after he's finished here?
I had his saddlebags searched after they were removed from Leary.
When he says no more, I turn, looking up into broody eyes that see so much. Too much. His arms are crossed, the sleeves of his black tunic rolled to the elbows, his hair held back in such a loose bun that tendrils hang around his face. He's the picture of savage regard. A fierce, sturdy presence. With his beast at my back and this massive, impenetrable male at my front, I should feel small, I don't. He's only ever made me feel vast, mighty, even. And perhaps he's right. There's something big brewing within me, something monstrous. I don't want to be here when it bursts. Well? Resolve softens his eyes.
He's heading back to Gore to chase down a lead. Most dragons can't fly for as long or as far as Rygon can, so they'll likely stop at Ovidon on the way for supplies, then again at Bothaim.
The city that straddles the border between the Fade and the Burn?
Correct. Neutral territory. Home of the Tri-Council Citadel.
I nod, my eyes unfocusing, mind ticking, tracing, weaving. Neutral land. I snap my attention back to Khan, opening my mouth.
I will have everything arranged for your departure once Leary is healed, and will do everything in my power to keep Rek in Dom until the day after you leave the city.
A wrestle of words dies on my tongue as a warm sprout of knowledge nestles between my ribs. He's letting me go, rather than clipping my wings and telling me all the valid reasons why I shouldn't do this. Rather than telling me we're yet to have our conversation, or demand he come with me to assure I don't remove him from my mind. Rather than shackle me in any way, shape, or form, he's blowing me back to the wind. My chest becomes heavy with the weight of a realization too multifaceted for me to ponder right now, with itchy feet and a whirring mind and bloodlust nipping at the tips of my fingers. I can understand why Elowen loved this male with her entire heart. He threads his hand around the small of my back, tucking me into his chest, warm lips brushing against my temple.
Come back to me, Rave. To us.
Then he's gone. Diary entry. Elowen Nevan. Age 20 phases. 5,041 phases after stone. We left this day with a storm cloud big enough to soften Slatra's journey across the plains. A parchment lark fluttering around Khan's sleep space for when he returns, stating that I'd enjoyed our time together, but that Tyroth's a more gifted sire and everything I need if I'm to breed healthy younglings to maintain my family line. To maintain our ability to protect the Aether Stone. I've never felt so vile, so rattled by the poisonous lie that I'm certain my heart solidified. Khan may never know he's everything to me, that I'd fall just to watch him fly. He may never know the youngling I carry is his, or that I'm pitted with a fear that I won't survive long enough to find a way to make this right. Pa thought I was remarkable, and once I believed it. Now I can't stand to look at my own filthy face.
Rek Zaros. Chapter 87. Bothaim. I drop onto a bar stool, the velvet snog alive with the whistle and drum of a small band, perched on stools in the corner of Bothaim's infamous inn. A place of comings and goings, of sealed deals and neutral agency. You never know who you're going to find here. Or what? Exactly why I like it. I cut a glance around the space, the irregular ceiling held up with stumpy stone pillars that remind me of rock trolls. Sconces reach from the wall like metal claws, casting the space in a bronze light that offsets the many dark corners folk like to fuck in. Another reason why I like it. Nothing better than a hot meal and a good show to get me in the mood for eating pussy and spilling blood. My two Erythian escorts settle on empty stools to my right, shucking off their silver cloaks and draping them on the bar. To my left, The male whose mount I caught a ride on the back of barely fits on his own stool, his chest a barrel, legs and arms the size of trunks. A brown bead hangs from one of the braids in his black, wiry beard. Taros. Decent guy. Bit quiet, but I like that. Nothing worse than feeling like you've got to talk to the cunt carting you across the kingdom on the back of his mount like a fucking priss. Sniffing, I catch a lingering whiff of ashen musk clinging to my cloak. The scent of the dragon I've taken a liking to. Hard to resist. Taros's large molten maw performed so beautifully during our long journey here from the Burns capital. Never once tossed his head or complained. Unlike the feral mutt I left in Thome. Leary couldn't travel long distances. Couldn't travel past Bothame without a fucking mask or squirming from a bit of sun. Moon plumes are supposed to be swift, cunning, and disastrous to their opponents. But all Leary gave me was bad attitude and twitchy heels. The bitch. Fucking glad to be rid of her. I'll be even more glad once I charm Bruce. The strong, sturdy mount. He bears thick, ruddy plumage that can ward off both the biting chill of the south and the harsh rays of the north. And he'll be mine once I slit Taros's throat. But first, I'll let the dull male have one final meal. Let him take one of the Velvet Snog's famous whores and fall into a sleep he'll never wake from. If there is anything I learned from Pa's regular whippings, it's that manners are of the utmost fucking importance. Taros looks sidelong at me, raising a dark brow. Hungry? He nods. Good. It's on me. I gesture to the barmaid to get her attention. Two molten meads and two coke steaks. The thick ones still on the bone. And with a side of cannet slaw. I lean closer to Taros, dropping my tone as I ask, how do you like yours cooked?
Still bleating, he grunts out.
Nice. I pull a smoke stick from my stash before relaying the details to the lusty-eyed barmaid. I also want a whore sent to my sleep suite. Blue eyes. I reach into my pocket for a small sack of bloodstone, dumping the lot on the bar. And I want the entire floor cleared out so I can make the bitch squeal without others listening in.
Of course.
She sweeps the sack off the table, pocketing it, then serves our meads and disappears through the back door. The four of us sit in silence, drinking while I watch a male finger a moaning whore who's draped across the bar with her tits out, jiggling with each rough thrust of his hand. It's tempting to jerk my hardening cock as I drag on my stick, blowing smoke rings skyward, listening to the hungry moans and conversations tittering around me, picking for threads on Princess Kazari's whereabouts. She knows I love to chase. That I fucking feed off it. I've decided that's why she chose to hand herself to the creators. Why she chose to run. When I find her, I'll give her exactly what she refuses to admit she wants. Me. The barmaid slides meat-laden plates before myself and Taros, boasting hunks of char-grilled coke wafting rich, fragrant steam. I cut into my serving, revealing shreds of fatty pink flesh I couple with some of the creamy slaw, moaning around the gluttonous mouthful. Good, right? I ask, looking at Taros. He grunts, stuffing his mouth with another laden bite, stare stabbed toward the back wall while he chews. Moody fucker, not even a thank you. Doesn't he know manners are important? Maybe I will make him suffer after all. Lash him a little.
I finish my meal, drain my mug, then stub my fifth smoke stick in the tray as I ease off the stool. I'm turning in. Were we not going to debrief first? One of the Arethians asks, frowning at me. Probably pissed I didn't buy him and his comrade a meal, too. I only buy meals from males I'm about to slaughter, so really, he's the lucky one. Debrief, I ask, playing dumb. Yes. He cuts a beady glance toward Taros, who's still munching through his meal, pretending he's not listening, that he hasn't been asked to report back once he returns to Dalm. Since we're, you know, splitting off? Since they're expected back in Arethia with any information they gleaned about Dalm's military status. Information they didn't get, since they ended up locked in their rooms under beaded guard the entire time. I shrug. Not my fault you failed. His face pales. I've got one job. Find the princess. Something I will achieve. Their shortcomings don't belong to me, the useless fucks. I've got a warm mouth waiting for me in my sleep space. So unless you want to drop to your knees and choke on me while I tell you everything you want to know, you can practice some fucking patience. I snatch my cloak and key from the barmaid who comes to clear my plate. We'll do it with the rise before we part ways. If I can be bothered, that is. I pull the door open, a smile cutting across my face when I see the shapely piece of ass stoking the large fireplace at the back of the room. Warm satisfaction spreads through me at the sight of her clothed in scraps of lace, visible through the sheer dark green cloak she's draped in, black hair piled on the top of her head. Her legs are long, hips round, waist tight, a curvy elegance to her that shoots straight to my hardening cock. Fuck, I grind out, kicking the door shut behind me, tossing my cloak and gloves on the ground. I stalk forward, lifting loose tendrils of hair off her elegant neck, wrapping my hand around the back of it and gripping hard. Perfect fit. I pinch the edge of her cloak, easing it off her pale shoulder. Aren't you a treat? I groan, unbuttoning my leather pants. I reach in and fist my solid cock in slow, tight drags. Just my type. She stuffs the metal poker deeper into the flames, making the sizzling logs crumble and hiss. You know, she murmurs in a smooth voice that pumps more blood into my loins. I'm not really a fan of fire. Weird thing to say to the male who just bought your body for the slumber. Why not? She makes a soft humming sound. Might have something to do with the time I spent in the pits. Fighting pits? Mm-hmm. Ah, role play. Not what I ordered, but fuck it. I'll buy it. Which ones? I ask, easing her cloak off her other shoulder, feeling it drop to the floor at our feet. The pits of Kindard. I chuckle against her warm flesh. Sweetheart, nobody makes it out of those pits alive. That's half the fun. I use the tip of my finger to paint a slithering line down her spine. Unless you're trying to tell me you're Firelark. This time, my chuckle is met with her own lilting laugh.
Gleetiano viri,
she whispers. And all the breath escapes my lungs in the same instance her hand swings back. Something sharp impales my thigh before she tosses a wooden handle into the fire, dispersing a blast of sparks as a chilling, gnawing silence settles within me.
What the fuck?
I stumble back, cradling my throat, my chest jerking for breath I can't catch. My other hand drops to my thigh, sweeping through the warm, wet liquid leaking from the wound. Fingers coming up so I can see the blood. The bitch stabbed me with an iron pin. I reach for the daggers stuffed in my bandolier, finding both empty, looking up in the same instant she tosses them in the fire, too. My lungs squeeze so tight I'm certain they're about to collapse as all the blood drains from my face, realization kicking me in the gut. She's been hunting me. The bitch has been fucking hunting me. I stumble toward the door, clawing at the spot where the handle's supposed to be, but all that's there is a fucking hole. I shove my fingers down, whipping them away when they slice against something sharp. Razors. The cunt. My bulging eyes threaten to burst from my sockets as I bash the door with my bloody fist. The air displaces to my right, and something smashes against my temple. A burst of sharp pain pitching through my skull. Gone. The Other. Chapter 88. The Other straddles Rek Zaros while studying him with overt curiosity, wondering where she should start, which part of him she should burn first.
Difficult decision, given there's so much of him to play with, and an entire slumber to have her fun. The tips of her fingers tingle with bloodlusting anticipation.
She reaches for his left wrist, making sure the bind is as well secured to him as it is to the pallet post, then repeats the process with his other hand and both feet, all the while musing over the silence inside her. Not even a flicker of presence seeping up. The one she loves did not fall easily into the watery den.
She battled and slashed, kicked and screamed.
Then only went still and quiet once the other packed her in a tomb of ice.
To protect her. This wreck must suffer a similar fate to the one he bestowed upon his dragon.
Something her precious rave would have struggled with. Much as she acts fierce and impervious to pain, it's mostly because she tosses the hurtful things down to gather like tombstones within the other's den. The other understands loss, death, and pain differently from rave, who is but a hatchling in her eyes.
But Rave will grow, adapt, embrace, and therefore conquer, if she is open to it. But first...
The other slaps Rex's cheek, probably a little too hard considering the way his head cracks to the side so fast his neck almost snaps and ruins all the fun. He groans, opening his eyes, blue like the glaciers in the shade. A nostalgic color that doesn't fit in his vile face.
No matter. She will scoop them out and rid him of them before the end.
His pupils tighten, his face turning a sickly shade of gray. A sharp smile stretches across the other's face. Rek thrashes, lifting his hips, trying to buck her off, bellowing, "Whore hag!" over and over again.
She can't be certain, but she wonders if he's trying to say, "You're dead," through the material she stuffed in his mouth.
The other chuffs.
Strictly speaking, he's not incorrect.
She pushes off and sways toward the fire with animalistic grace, gripping the end of a stoker roasting in the flames, poking at embers that glint off her black, glitter-kissed eyes. She pulls it out, the space alive with Rex's panicked grunting sounds as he jerks and wrestles against his restraints. Then he stills, eyes widening on the sharp tip of the metal tool, blazing with a hot, radiant beat. She prowls toward him in long-legged strides.
You know, I saw what you did to that moonplume,
she muses, climbing onto the pallet again.
I heard how she wailed.
She brings the poker's fiery tip to his left eye, sizzling the ends of his lashes, lacing the air with the potent musk of burning hair. His bloodshot eyes water. The other clicks her tongue, whipping the weapon away.
No, you protected her eyes, didn't you? That was nice. A small mercy that was not bestowed upon herself many cycles ago. I'll deal with them in a different way.
She drops the blazing poker to his naked chest and draws a jagged line. Rex screams, his muffled cries of pain turning to whittled whimpers, his tendons taut and risen. He begins to tremble beneath her, the room packing so full of the smell of roasted flesh that the other realizes how hungry she is.
Not that she intends to eat him. No.
Rave was quite repulsed when she learned the other had chewed off this male's finger.
Leading the other to spend some time pondering whether or not she should be more considerate with the way she uses her host's pliant, precious body. Eating this wreck is probably a step too far. Unfortunate, considering how delicious his fried flesh smells. No, must not.
Shoving down her natural urges, the other lifts the weapon from the line of sizzled flesh.
Though you may not have understood Leary's pained sounds, I did.
His eyes bulge, and he looks at the other like she's utterly mad. His nostrils flared, chest bucking with the violent beat of his panicked breaths.
Unlucky for you,
she sneers, tipping her head to the side.
I'm here to show you exactly how she felt.
The acrid smell of his urine fills the room. She paints another sizzling trail across his chest, down his tensing abdomen. Wreck jerks and jerks, fierce primal satisfaction shaping the other's features into a vision of savage glee.
Then I'm going to use your own metal spurs to dig holes all over your body before slashing what's left of you with that whipping tool you cart around.
Another groan as she digs the poker deep, deeper, then tosses the thing. It clatters across the stone floor, coming to a halt by the wall. Wreck chokes and heaves, his wide, wild stare bouncing around the room, like he's searching for something that can help free him of this predicament.
Too bad for him. The one she loves was thorough with her preparation. Impressively so.
There is nothing here to save him.
Vath,
the other whispers, and Rex's gaze whips up to meet hers. She hears his heart skip a beat, feeds on the pulse of his surprise as a bulb of flame flutters from the open fireplace and settles in the palm of her clawed hand.
She can almost hear the thump of his thoughts.
No doubt, churning over the fact that she can wield three elemental songs, not just Claude and Boulder, as he'd witnessed in the Undercity. He doesn't know about rain.
Doesn't know it's actually four.
Neither does the one she loves. The other having gone out of her way to absorb Ignos's spitting, scalding tune.
So it doesn't
trigger her strong but delicate host until she's ready.
She tilts her head, the motion smooth and animalistic.
Do you know how it feels for a moon plume to scald in the sun's harsh rays, Rek Zaros?
He shakes his head, whimpering, his stare flicking between the fire in her hand and her rattling leer.
A bit like this?
She sneers, then paints his face in flames.
Veya. Chapter 89. There's a coldness about this place that digs all the way to your marrow. I blame it on the fact that I'm not used to it, that I was born and raised north of the wall. Toss me amongst endless plains of snow, flurried storms, and breaths that make your lungs feel frostbitten, and I'm suddenly questioning every life decision that led me here, to this moment, walking through the sable halls of Arithia's grand imperial palace, dressed in the stark silver garb of a servant. My long flowing skirt rustles with every step, a plain blouse buttoned to my nape where it meets a collar of fur that matches the tufted cuffs around my wrists. Not nearly enough layers to battle this bone-biting chill. The vast size of this palace is boggling, the building cut into the side of a jagged, snow-covered mountain like spears of obsidian shot up from the ground, reaching for the numerous rounded moons nesting in the sky. All of Arithia is cast in a whimsical, pearly glow that penetrates through the many windows in this haunting palace. So many windows that, with every turn up the obsidian stairway, I'm granted another fragmented view through panes crafted to look like shattered glaciers, made from thousands of shards in every tone of blue, silver, and white. On and on I go, up the ever-winding stairs that are buffed to a high gleam, skirts shushing in my wake, unsure why I'm going up. Something in my gut, I guess. Not something I want to look in the eye any longer than I have to. Get in, get the diary, get the fuck out. Coming to an ornamental mirror on the wall, I pause, tucking strands of pale hair behind my pointed ears, checking my sharp, pretty features and blue eyes for any cracks in my imitative appearance, jarring as it is to see myself as not me. Truly, very weird. My silver, appearance-altering bangle hangs heavy around my wrist as I rearrange some strands back into place. A bangle with a hidden spike I used to poke both my finger and that of the female now bound, gagged, and unconscious in a cupboard in the servants' quarters on the ground floor, with a pillow under her head, because I'm nice like that. Too bad I didn't think to ask the poor thing for directions before I knocked her out. This palace is a labyrinth, each doorway bracketed by stern, silver-armored guards known as thorns. The hallways haunted by a constant stream of stone-faced maids bustling about the place, keeping its many sharp edges perfectly polished. A bit like a gleaming trophy Tyroth is obviously very proud of. The fuck. A dark-haired female dressed in the same garb as myself pours down the stairway in a swish of silver, her eyes widening when she sees me. Ada? She nips a glance over her shoulder, her next words a quiet hiss. You're not supposed to be down here. Ada. Guess that's my name. Good to know. She slows, frowning. Are you okay? What are you doing? Hunting for the ancient diary of Elowin Rave Navan, hoping it hasn't turned to compost in a wall somewhere. Well, you see, have you already been up there? That's a baited question I certainly didn't prepare for. Beginning to think I might have pricked the wrong maid. No? Her eyes almost bug out of her head. You're expected in the king's chambers right now. My heart lurches. Actually, that's exactly where I need to go. I lost my way, I say, offering her an awkward smile. I didn't sleep well. In fact, I rub my temple. I'm suddenly all confused about the levels. I think I lost track somewhere down. She snatches my arm, tucks it into the crook of hers, and tugs me farther up the stairs, past two thorns moving against our grain before she leans close, speaking in a hushed tone. We're on 11. You have another 23 to climb. Of course. I let loose a soft laugh similar to the one I heard the real Ada make while I trailed her momentarily in the bowels of the palace, right before I knocked her unconscious. Silly me. The female pulls a silken dusting stick from the pocket of her apron and wraps my hand around the cold handle. You need to at least look useful going in there, or the other females in the palace will talk, and that will displease him greatly. You know what he's like. Yes, I do know what he's like. Sadistic fucking asshole. I flash her another smile. Thank you. I left mine somewhere. Muttering something beneath her breath, she peels away, then turns back down the stairs, disappearing from sight. I keep shoving up the twisting stairway that seems to go on and on, doing my best to count the levels. Easier said than done, since some are stouter than others. Some. The stairway is woven through the air of wide-open atriums like a black squiggle, the atmosphere spiced with the sweet, intoxicating smell of illuminated flowers in full bloom, their glowing heads tipped to the windows. I step onto a level with a lofty ceiling veined in silver threads, a grand double door directly ahead that's bracketed by two sets of thorns, their shoulder pads flaring to pointed peaks. Silver helmets cover most of their faces, wings splayed from the sides that accentuate the tapered tips of their ears. Each of them wields a long iron sword, pointed down, both hands wrapped around the hilt. Swords that are almost longer than me. My breath catches at the sight of the door, something inside my brain wiggling like a worm I can't quite manage to pluck free and inspect. Even if it weren't for the extra guards, I'm somehow certain this is the place. This is the sleep suite where Elowin died. My gaze darts from guard to guard. I've got dusting to do, I say, waving my stick. None of them even glance my way, though one of them raises a brow. Right. Permission to proceed. Clearing my throat, I move forward when the door swings inward, releasing a familiar ashen scent. My heart leaps into my throat. I slide back a step, dipping my head. Holding. Paralyzed. In my direct line of sight, a silver thorn-tipped boot pierces my view as I'm shoved within the crackling atmosphere of Tyroth Vagor. Heart thrashing. Thoughts churning. Certain he's looking at me with scarcely veiled vitriol in his eyes, like I'm a bug he wants to burn. Certain he's about to shape his mangled thoughts into words that'll crush my throat with their monstrous fists. That'll make me feel small and weak and so fucking quiet. My tongue too heavy to speak. There's a long beat of silence, and I find my trembling hand tightening around the duster, the other reaching for the dagger I have stuffed in the deep pocket of my skirt.
You're late, Ada.
The foreign name snaps at my spine, reminds me that I'm not Tyroth's sister, not at the moment. I'm not the one that took his mother from him, the one he hates and has since I was far too young to hate him back. To even understand. I force my fingers to loosen their hold on the weapon I promised I wouldn't use, pull my hand from my pocket, and fist the fabric of my skirt instead. Apologies, sire. I dip lower, willing my heart to ease up on the white-knuckle blows to my ribs. I overslept. Won't happen again. My breath snags as his fingers pinch my chin, forcing me to look into his cruel, cutthroat eyes. One green, like Ma's apparently were. One pitch black, just like the pit of his septic soul. His black hair is half pulled up, the rest hanging loose around his shoulders, tumbling all the way to his elbows. His beard is, as always, adorned with a trio of beads. Clear, brown, red. He's bigger than I remember, two heads taller than me and almost as wide as Khan in the shoulders, his presence one of scarcely veiled chaos that contrasts his impeccable silver garb.
Well, nice of you to finally show up, he says with that cutting sort of serenity that always makes me picture myself bleeding out with a stab wound I didn't realize he'd stuck me with.
Tell me, Ada, do you think that carrying my bastard brings you certain privileges?
My mind empties so fast I'm certain the ground tips beneath my feet, like the entire palace just dislodged from the toothy mountainscape and is now swaying side to side, trying to decide which direction it wants to fall. What do I say to that?
I have a child, an heir, disobedient as she is,
he grits out, like there's a fireball of frustration welling on his tongue.
I don't need another, and my tolerance of your condition dissolves the moment you no longer prove useful to me.
My guts knot, words choking past my swollen throat. I, of course, sire, apologies, and thank you.
For?
Your tolerance. Definitely picked the wrong maid to prick. A line forms between his brows, though it smooths when a parchment lark flutters close, quickly returning again when the damn thing dips between us and nudges against my chest. My heart drops so fast it almost falls out my ass.
This is unusual,
he says in that chilling way he speaks, snatching the thing, keeping his eyes on me as he unfolds it while my pulse pounds in rhythm with my slashing thoughts. Fuck, fuck, fuck. He waves it at me, both brows bumping toward his hairline.
It's blank.
Internally, I smile, because it's not blank. Not at all. Whenever either of us are beyond the safety of Dom, Khan and I write our notes in invisible ink, illuminated only by dragon flame we both carry a weld of. Precautions. Never came in handy until now.
A dud, perhaps.
He's swift to rip the wings off the thing and toss its non-fluttering corpse to the floor. A visceral reminder of my brother's brutality I didn't need.
I have business to attend to, but I'll be back in a couple of hours. Go inside, get on your knees with a polish cloth, and make yourself useful until I return.
He turns and stalks toward the stairs.
Keep me waiting again, and I'll have your head.
The tips of my fingers tingle with the sudden, violent urge to spray his blood across the perfectly polished floor, my upper lip twitching to pull back from my canines. My foot kicks forward, hand digging into my pocket as if to grip my blade so I can leap and slash. No. I tug my hand free and fist it at my side, trying to squeeze the tingles away. One, I said I wouldn't kill him and start an impromptu war Khan's not yet fully prepared for. Two, not like this. Not coming at him from behind, wearing the skin of another. I want to look him in the eye, make him bleed the way I've bled, hurt the way I've hurt. I want to spit the words that have been festering in my mouth for far too long, bruising my gums every time I stand paralyzed in his presence. Anything less will be like a sip of water that turns to lava in my throat. I tell myself that over and over as I watch Tyroth move down the stairs, relieved I spent a few hours folded over an ice boulder on the city's outskirts, vomiting from this dagger of dread lodged in my gut. If I'd had anything left in there, it would be on the floor at my feet right now, or splattered against Tyroth's silver boots. Can't believe I knocked out his pregnant mistress. How horrible, when the poor thing is already living a slumber terror. I make a mental note to pad her pockets with enough bloodstone to buy her a better life before I wake her from her forced sleep and go on my way. Tyroth disappears from sight, and I release a shaken exhale, my body loosening in places I didn't know had tightened. I spin, picking up the deceased lark and tucking it in my pocket, then move into the vast chambers, letting the doors click shut behind me. Eyes squeezed shut, I rest my head against the ebony wood and pull my lungs so full they ache, trying to shift the tightness from my chest. I pass the duster from one hand to the other, shaking both out, dashing the last of the tingles away. Get the diary. Get out. Wake Ada up so she can rush up here and avoid getting her head lopped off. I open my eyes, widening as I take in this stark black sitting room with panoramic views of the glittering city far below, seeing his sleep suite through an open door to the left. I move through, pausing at the foot of the huge obsidian four-poster pallet. My eyes narrow on a large mirror on the far wall. It has to be there. I make for it, cast a quick glance over my shoulder, then set the duster on the pallet and slide the mirror sideways, expecting to see a hollow. My heart drops. Nothing. Just a flat wall. I appraise the space. There's nothing else on the walls in this sterile room, meaning she can't possibly have hidden it here. But this is where she spent the last chapter of her life. I know that for a fact, that she was too unwell to even make it into the streets and see her folk, to celebrate the impending birth, something that meant so much to all Erythians, since conceiving has never come easy to those who don the Aether Stone. I look to the balcony, realization slapping me so hard my knees almost give way. Half the room was crumbled when her moonplume broke through the wall after Elowyn passed away, scooping up her lifeless body she then carried into the sky where she curled around her and died. Perhaps she tore up the diary, too. Shit, I mutter, dropping to the pallet, dragging my hands down my Ada's face. I should have thought of that before I flew all the way here. A deep wash of failure sweeps over me, the weight of it shoving me back onto the thick, cushiony pallet, tossing my arms out as I stare at the black velvet canopy. I've been compulsively chasing a truth that doesn't belong to me, that never did. Guess this is what I get. Sweet fuck all. Creators, this room feels morbid and cold. What a shitty place to be stuck, rise after rise, pitted with the knowledge that you'll probably die giving birth. Probably too exhausted to even walk to the balcony and get a clear view of the moons. I lift my head, looking toward the balcony door, panes of glass that frame the sky littered with bowled up gray, pearly, and iridescent moons. My heart skips a beat. If she were pallet-ridden, she would have hidden it within reach. Surely. Why make things harder on herself? Frowning, I sit up, imagining my belly is laden with life, imagining I have a diadem on my brow that's draining me to death, making it almost impossible for me to draw enough energy to breathe, let alone nourish my youngling into existence. Imagining that I'd want to look out at those moons right there. Mostly, the one belonging to Hadion. I edge myself off the side of the mattress, dropping straight down onto my ass on the floor beside it, looking out the balcony door to a perfectly framed view of Hayes Perch. A sad smile lifts the corner of my lips. This feels right. Devastatingly right. I plunge my left arm under the risen pallet, eyes on that gimpy-winged moon spilling its silver luster upon Erythia as I feel around the back post, across the back wall. My hand pushes into a jagged hollow, a lump forming in my throat as my fingers graze across the face of a leather-bound book. There you are. I pull it into my lap, tracing my finger over the black and silver depiction of Khan's Malmer, something she must have painted on the otherwise black front. The backs of my eyes sting at the sight. Oh, Elowen, I whisper, hand trembling. I nip a glance toward the door before I lift the front cover, flipping through the yellowed flaps of parchment, each so beautifully scrawled upon. Even when she was small, her handwriting was immaculate, all dainty curls and twirls. Just looking at each entry makes me feel as though I'm tumbling through a veil into another world seen only through her eyes. First the young her, then the adolescent, then the mature. Lacking the time to read the entire thing right here, right now, but also lacking a single shred of patience, I flip straight to the end, to the final three entries, immediately regretting it, realizing I shouldn't have read this here. I shouldn't have read this at all. My hand flies up and cups my mouth that I can't seem to shut, my heart growing more laden with each barbed word I swallow, with each soul-crushing, life-changing word that doesn't belong to me. But I'm already there. I'm already invested, intertwined. Reaching the final entry, I pull a shuddered breath and force myself to continue.
Diary entry. Elowen Nevan, age 21 phases, 5,042 phases after stone. Every cycle I grow bigger, yet weaker in my bones. Almost too weak to reach into my hiding spot to retrieve my diary and read of happier times that remind me there's still some good in this world. The city folk celebrate in the streets each day, as if my youngling is already here, as if the ashes of my loved ones don't still taint the very air we breathe. If Tyroth suspects the babe isn't his, he hasn't let on. Not that we speak at all. Not that I have anything I want to speak to him about. I've heard from one of his loyal aides, the only folk I'm allowed contact with, that a bloodlace has arrived on Dragonback this rise. If she's here to test my youngling's blood once I give birth, the paternal line won't draw in Tyroth's direction. It'll draw north, to Khan. All I'm allowed to do is wither here, bleeding my life force into this youngling, occasionally drawing enough energy to slide off the pallet and garner myself a clear view of Hadeon's moon. I sing to it, and I swear I can hear it singing back, like it's calling me. I want to curl up with Slatra, to be with her while I labor, but I struggle to move on my own anymore. All but stuck on this pallet where Ma and Pa died, where I pretended to conceive a youngling that was already seated inside me. This pallet that used to be filled with love and song, but now reeks of death and pain. A battle is coming. I can feel it in my bones, like my body is shoring up the courage to charge into a war I don't think I'm going to survive. Even if I do, I feel like there's a scythe hanging over my head, waiting to slice. Either way, my heart is heavy with a seed of understanding I can't dislodge, that I will climb back upon the pallet once I whisper goodbye to Hadeon's moon, and I won't rise from it again. Casting my stare up at the sky, I sob through short, sharp breaths that are so far from adequate. She lied for us. For him. Khan. She lied for the youngling she carried all the way from their love den in Dom to this cold, caustic room where she'd lost so much already, all because she believed the words that spat out of my pa's mouth. And for what? To die right here. To not see Kaisari grow. For Tyroth to raise Khan's daughter as his own. I close the diary, a venomous truth settling in my chest like a serpent poised to strike. These pages are going to rip the world to shreds.
The Scavenger King. Epilogue. From deep within the inky clutches of a shadow too dense for the average eye to see within, the Scavenger King studies the young female fae coiled in the corner of her cell, rocking back and forth, hands threaded deeper into her pale hair. Eyes squeezed shut, she mumbles a chain of incoherent words, perhaps hewn from the crevices of her swelling insanity. She's speaking to someone, of that he's certain, just as certain as he is that this particular someone only exists within the confines of her peculiar mind. His head tips sideways as he studies her more deeply. Red lips, large eyes mantled with a thick fan of lashes, a shapely elegance the likes of only one he's encountered before. His Firelark. She holds such uncanny resemblance, but her eyes are softer, her skin a touch darker, and though his Firelark came to him without words, this female, well, she has plenty, entire rambling conversations. They just make no sense. To him. Yet on she mumbles, the dark dents beneath her eyes a tribute to the diadem clinging to her brow, its fine silver tendrils seeming to meld with her skin. Her face twists, a tear slipping down her sallow cheek. The Scavenger King watches it drip off her chin and seep into her soiled tunic, a crease forming between his brow as he muddles over this other difference. His Firelark never cried. Not once she bit into life like some wild animal, snarling around her messy feast. She did not leave scraps. She simply consumed. This female, however, exists delicately, with all the decorum of someone raised in a palace, with servants to feed her, groom her, teach her, a loving paw to speak for her. Stepping free of the shadows, Arkin clears his throat. The female stops rocking, eyes snapping open, glossy, bold blue orbs staring at him through the gloom.
You will release me,
she bites out, dashing the tear from her cheek. Arkin clicks his tongue, glancing around her cell, taking in its plush details. A crumpled blanket, a straw pallet, a tray bearing an empty bowl from one of her regular meals. She even has a wooden bucket so she's not forced to shit where she sleeps. More home comforts than he offers other prisoners. She is, after all, his niece. Not that she knows that. Not that any of his half-brothers knows he exists, as far as he's aware. But they will. That's exactly what I've come to offer, he says, crouching before the curve of bone bars and easing his hand through, a piece of parchment pinched between two outstretched fingers. Release. Her eyes widen. She scurries forward in a clatter of iron chains,
snatching the piece of parchment and smoothing it on the ground. She frowns up at him, tucking strips of matted hair behind her pointed ear.
It's blank.
I need you to sign your name, Arkin states, threading a runed quill through the bars. She takes it, scratching out her signature while he studies the pretty skin on her hands, stuffing down the urge to burn it, if just a little bit. See if she, too, refuses to scream. He certainly doesn't acknowledge that it's more complicated than that, that he's resentful of her plush life, of the way her pa dotes on her. Loves her. Nor does he acknowledge that he's curious to see how she would fare were she cast into the volcanic plains and told to run, while a roar of fire nips at her heels, sizzles her flesh. Would she carve out a life for herself in the barren hollows of an unloved terrain? Would she forge her weakness into a fearsome strength? Would she thrive? She passes the note and quill back through the bars, a hopeless sheen to her eyes. No wonder his half-brother protected her so. She's but a pretty ornamental flower, and flowers singe in the face of flames. He decides she would not thrive at all. She would die, as he almost did too many times to count. He leaves without words or flair, the torn hem of his cloak fluttering in his wake as he moves through the elaborate tangle of cold, dark burrows, only stopping once he comes to his personal suite. He sits at his perfectly polished desk lit by a blazing candelabra stolen from someone long ago and spreads the parchment upon the tabletop. He studies the bounty of treasures surrounding him. His suite, a conglomeration of only the best, most interesting bits he scavenged over the phases. The princess had fallen into his lap as a sign from the creators. He was certain. Too good an offer to pass up, given she immediately demanded he send a lark to the Burn King himself. Not a single mention of her doting pa. Andy, seeing he has no interest in the shade. The only seat he cares about is the bronze throne of the Burn that rightfully belongs to him. This is it. The very moment he's been channeling toward for so long. Arkin sits straighter, quill poised as he looks down. For the first time, he examines the flat of parchment, pausing, smiling. She signed, yes. But amongst the scroll, in a tiny, almost indiscernible script she did well to meld with the shape of her name, is a single sentence. Kill the sadistic fuck. He chuckles, scratching his own note upon the empty space before folding the parchment lark down its activation lines, giving it life, whispering a name upon its fluttering wings. She has more bite than he'd anticipated. Perhaps he was wrong about her. Perhaps she would survive after all. The same, however, cannot be said about her uncle. No. He has plans for the great Khan Vagor, who took Arkin's revenge for himself. And none of them are pretty. The parchment lark takes flight, soaring from the scavenger king's personal suite and out into the halls. It weaves through the underground warren toward the world outside, bypassing a different lark on its way past the cells. A small wobbly one, with a tear in its wing and a blood splotch on its tail. The damaged lark dips between two bars to where Princess Kazari is bound on the ground in a ball beneath her filthy blanket. The scoop of her hand, a landing pad, the little lark dives toward,
face first, crushing its nose against her fingers. Kazari flinches, opens her eyes. The lark flips onto its back, bearing three small, perfectly scripted letters upon the underside of its belly. Ni.
Trigger warnings. Blood and gore. Death and violence. Sexually explicit. Torture. Implied threat of sexual assault. Sexual predator. Explicit language. Cruelty toward a creature. Abuse. Abduction of an adult. Implied off-page and post-recounting. Death in childbirth. Implied off-page. Abduction and trafficking of minors. Implied off-page. Miscarriage. Implied for a secondary character. Off-page. One last reminder. For access to the glossary, family tree, and more, don't forget to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of When the Moon Hatched, a novel by Sarah A. Parker, performed by Sarah Mallow Christensen and Fager Alcasey, presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Abigail Marks. Text copyright 2023 by Sarah A. Parker. Production copyright 2024 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.